Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. The Marines say they have not yet launched the battle for Baghdad, but they are already there to stay. In the latest U.S. push into the heart of the capital, the armored fighting vehicles and tanks have encountered some stiff resistance, but there have also been a good number of Iraqi soldiers abandoning their weapons and fleeing. And while we bring you news of the attack on that city this hour, we're going to set our sights stateside and explore the state and safety of the home front as well. Homeland security remains a key issue in Congress and in cities and towns across the country. Connection listeners, there have been so many predictions that this war in Iraq will bring new terrorist activity to the United States. Are you comfortable with the security that's in place here in America or in your town? And how much responsibility should civilians take for homeland security while the government has the nation on orange alert? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, we have guests on standby to talk about safety in America. We'll meet them in just a moment. First, though, to the latest news from Iraq, and this from Baghdad. A convoy of American tanks and armored vehicles rolled into the capital city earlier today after a series of incursions during the past few days, described as raids and reconnaissance missions. This time, Army sources say the 2nd Brigade plans to stay. Earlier, the unit stormed the main presidential palace and blew up a statue of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad's Zahra Park. Officials at Central Command said this morning that the presence of troops in Baghdad sends, quote, a powerful message to the remnants of the regime that we can go where we want, when we want. In other news from Baghdad, two U.S. soldiers and two journalists are reported to have been killed in a rocket attack on a U.S. communications center. That's on the southern outskirts of Baghdad just a few hours ago. No names have been released there. In other developments, U.S. Marines have taken the headquarters of the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission east of Baghdad, where they apparently found protective suits, masks, and substances that they're working to identify. Another Iraqi storage site that may have been used for chemical weapons was found south of Hindaya. Unconfirmed reports indicate the site could contain sarin, a highly lethal nerve agent, but as I said, those are still unconfirmed report. This, of course, is key for two reasons. U.S. soldiers need to know what the threat to them will be while they're in the process of attacking Baghdad, but also there's important political evidence that the U.S. and Britain would be looking for in the search for weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons. Baghdad, of course, is key. We'll be watching that city. We'll bring you news through the hour if there are any changes there. Fighting also continued in southern Iraq over the weekend as British forces moved to consolidate their hold on Basra. Thanasi Kambanis is a correspondent with the Boston Globe. He was in Basra watching the British decision to move into the center of that city.
It was pretty incredible progress over the space of just 3 days, in fact. The first day we went up there, the British were holding a position just over a bridge, really on the outside of the city. And then in one fell swoop, the next night, they advanced about a kilometer and blew out an Iraqi army barracks and cleared out a satellite camp to the university. And then last night, they had a firefight with a group of what they described as Fedayeen, something like the Afghan Arabs. These were Arabs from other countries, including Syria and Egypt, who were fighting with a few Iraqi regular army soldiers inside the university complex. And once they took that, they've gone clear through the city. This is the second day that they've been patrolling on foot inside the center of the city, and they've gone all the way up to the Medina, the old part of the city, and to the Chatt al-Arab waterway.
Did you get into the city yourself, Thanasi?
We did. We went all the way into the center, and it's quite a scene. The main thing you notice right away is the looting. The looting began yesterday afternoon. The government fled, by most eyewitness accounts, around 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and almost instantaneously, residents of the city just swarmed into every public building. Now, that's everything from ministries to the government oil complex to the customs warehouse where people were stealing entire brand-new truck rigs, new air conditioning units from the state oil company, office chairs. Now, this morning, out around the university, British tanks had lined the perimeter, and people were navigating through with office chairs loaded with printers and computers. And this is something that's caused a lot of grief for residents of the city. When we talk to people today, the first thing out of their mouths, even before they spoke about what they thought of the coalition occupying the city, was, why is there no law and order? Why are the tanks standing by while people rip our city apart? The public resources of the city are being stripped, and as far as how that bodes for the reconstruction effort, there's going to be a lot of work to be done just to restore things, not even to make them better than they were before, but to actually restore them to the state of affairs even 2 weeks ago.
Thanasi, for all the time that Basra has been under siege by the British, there's been intense speculation as to how well the citizens were doing when the British were sending their mortars and shells into the city. Can you give us any indication of the injuries, the deaths in the city itself?
We went to Basra General Hospital, and the director said that there have been about 1,200 civilian deaths during the two-week campaign. Right now, there are about 500 wounded, shrapnel from bomb hits, tank hits, and the state of the city has been. I mean, part of the problem was the lack of water, because the treatment plant went offline right before the war. Right now, the hospital does not have any water. They're depending on trucked water, and for 2 days they haven't gotten any shipments in, and that's made it difficult for them to treat the wounded. There's also lots of reports, and I can't say I've been able to confirm any of these, of direct hits on civilian homes, including actually the home of a very prominent doctor in the city who works at the International Red Cross, and several members of his family were killed 3 days ago in what appears to be a bombing raid.
With so many people injured and so many killed, what are the people in Basra saying to the soldiers? Is there resentment, or is there a sense of relief that Saddam Hussein's grip on the city may finally now be released?
Like everywhere I've been in Iraq over the last 10 days, even with British or American soldiers standing right by, people will lean forward and tell you, "We can't speak. We can't speak freely. We don't know whether Saddam's forces are really gone, and we're not going to be able to tell you what we really think." What they're telling the soldiers is the sort of simple, you know, thumbs up, glad to see you. But in the more lengthy conversations we had with people today, there was a lot of anger over the bombing, a lot of anger over what they see as the invasion of their city by a foreign army that they don't believe has their interest at heart, and that for the immediate purposes of the quality of their lives right now, they are they appear to be worse off than they said they were 2 weeks ago. Law and order is gone. The water system is gone. Their phones don't work. Many of them have relatives who've been killed. So for the short term, they're not seeing liberation and reconstruction as something that's making their world either safer or more free.
Thanasi, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for your time.
Thanasi Kambanis is a correspondent with the Boston Globe. I spoke to him earlier this hour. And as I said at the beginning of the program, this hour a chance to track both fronts in the war on terror, Iraq, and we'll keep you up to date if there are developments coming from either Baghdad or any of the other fronts there over the course of the next hour. But, of course, here in America is the other front that we want to focus on. We invite your questions and comments on the state of homeland security. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. In just a few minutes, we'll be checking in with Olathe, Kansas, and Seattle to find out what's going on across the country. But I'd like to introduce Robert Falzgraf, who's a professor of international security studies at Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Robert's also founder of the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis, and he's with me in the studio. Welcome to The Connection.
Happy to be here.
Robert, tell me, as we spend so much time focusing on what's happening in Iraq, and I mean, you'll have to agree, it's a pretty compelling sort of story to watch these days. Is it hard for, in your view, for the nation to focus in the way that it should on what needs to be done here in the United States?
Well, I like to think that we have a new framework for national security, and that includes, shall we say, from Tora Bora and from Afghanistan and Iraq to Boston, Massachusetts, or Cambridge, Massachusetts, or wherever we might be in the United States. So we really have to keep our eye on both fronts. It's one large arena in which we need to operate.
Now, you've been doing a lot of studies and advice in particular for the government of Massachusetts, but in general terms, is it your view, Robert, that what can be done in terms of preparing the nation for some, we don't know where it's going to happen, terrorist attack, about everything that can be done has been done?
Well, we will never know if everything that can be done has been done until and unless we have a terrorist incident of some kind. But certainly since 9/11, a great deal has been done that we can catalog, that we can see as we walk around our cities and towns. And, of course, we have also done a great deal to find out where the attack might come from. And that may be one of the important accomplishments. I'm thinking here of what we did with regard to taking down the Taliban and also the Al-Qaeda central command structure, to the extent that there is one, in Afghanistan. The numbers of Al-Qaeda we've captured, the most recent number three man in the organization. We know a great deal more than we did before about this operation. So we need to look at it from, I think, a standpoint that begins overseas and ends right here at home. We've done a lot at home, of course, also, that we could talk about here.
Now, one of the things that you've been saying in your writing about the threat that nobody can really identify is that terrorists tend to focus their attention on a target that may not be an expected target, that one of the reasons that 9/11 was so successful in their terms was that it wasn't the sort of attack that might necessarily have been expected. So when Homeland Security means putting Black Hawk helicopters and aircraft circling above New York City, I'm wondering whether or not that's the sort of focus or attention, or whether or not people need to be thinking in slightly more creative terms about where the threats could come from.
Well, we, of course, need to think in creative terms, but we also know from documents that we've captured that there are certain categories of targets that they have chosen. One would be targets of symbolic value, such as, say, the USS Constitution or the Golden Gate Bridge in California. Second would be targets that have economic value, such as the World Trade Center. Thirdly, targets that represent the center of political power, such as the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. Those are the types of targets that they have chosen, and targets that would also kill large numbers of civilians. I emphasize civilians because far more civilians have died than military, even in the Pentagon attack on 9/11.
So the one thing that 9/11 has taught us is what the inspiration or what the motivation for the terrorists would be, and it's helped clarify the nature of the targets.
It has helped to do that, but as you point out in the question you're asking me, we don't know exactly. We have so many targets that fit these categories, and that's where access to up-to-date intelligence that is widely and quickly disseminated, say from the federal level down to the state and local level, is so important in knowing where we can put the limited protective assets. After all, our law enforcement personnel cannot be everywhere all the time. It's just impossible to think about that.
All right. We'll be talking more about the state and local and city and municipal and town response in the war on terror, the homeland security investment that this country's making. And we'd like to hear from you at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. The news from Iraq has certainly pushed news of homeland security out of the headlines for the past couple of weeks, although we're bound to see more about it this week as the Senate and the House get down to the last few punches in their agreements and disagreements over just exactly how much money will be set aside in the supplementary request for homeland security. And to get a sense how people are seeing it across the country. We thought we'd bring in Rita Hoffman. She is Emergency Management Coordinator in Olathe, Kansas. Rita, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And Nick Licata is joining us. He is a councilman in Seattle. Hi, Nick.
Good morning.
Let me start, Rita, if I can, with you. Well, actually, let me start by congratulating you, because I understand that you were just recently given the title of Emergency Manager Coordinator of the Year for 2002 in your area. Am I right?
That's right, for the State of Kansas Emergency Management Association.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, you've been busy getting volunteers on the issue of homeland security and emergency management. Am I right?
We have been working on our Community Emergency Response Team program, which started in the spring of 2001 here in the city of Olathe. Countywide, we've been working on this program for several years, but we've been focusing on that program here in our city.
And the money that you would need for that, is it substantial in any way? Or when I say volunteers, is it really being done with local resources?
We have been fortunate so far in the past few years to be subsidized by Project Impact grants, and we just turned in a proposal through our county that will go to the state to apply for Citizen Corps money as well.
And Nick Licata, what's happening in Seattle? Have you got any specific money, either from the state or from Washington yet, to help with homeland security? Being a port city, this has got to be a pretty big concern.
It is a very big concern. We've put requests in for federal money. None's come in, and most of the state money would, in fact, probably originate outside the state. Our state budget has been going through severe financial crisis, as has the city. The state budget's been cut back quite a bit. Nevertheless, we still, over the last 2 years, have totaled up close to $7 million in costs for additional security.
But this all at a time when you're doing some fairly dramatic cutting in your city budget, am I right?
Well, at the same time, right. We're cutting our budget by over $60 million, and we're adding an additional $7 million for everything from police, fire, health, our utilities, adding additional staff.
So that means that the first responder teams that you'll have in Seattle will be better equipped? They may be a little bit bigger as we look ahead?
Well, a lot of it's just getting up the infrastructure. You need to make certain capital investments. We have dams out here, for instance, regarding our water supply. We had to hire a chief information security officer. Then there's little things like additional building security, things of that sort. So, for instance, 70% of our total cost was in 2002. So it could even be higher in 2003.
Now, Rita, as I listen to Nick describe the points of concern in and around Seattle, I'm wondering, when you look around you in Olathe, Kansas, what are the reasons for pumping up homeland security in your area?
Well, we all have critical infrastructure that we're concerned about. We're in the process of going through a complete revamping of our hazard and vulnerability analysis and a mitigation program to identify all those critical places. But we, like every other city, has had cutbacks in support monetarily from the state and the city vantage point. So we're looking at every aspect we can to bone up on our infrastructure and our homeland security initiatives without any, at the current time, additional monies from the state or the federal government.
Rita, let me ask you something. To what extent are ordinary people involved in homeland security in any kind of neighborhood watch? I don't know. I mean, you'd be better at explaining that. But what's your sense of how the average citizen's involved?
Well, in many cases, the average citizen doesn't understand that preparedness is not just something a government agency does for them, that it involves you, it involves me, it involves every citizen. We do have a really good neighborhood watch program through our police department here, and we have worked with that program in educating people that it's not just crime prevention or fire prevention we want them to be on top of, but all disaster preparedness. So we're focusing on all hazard preparedness as an everyday concept.
But what are you saying, that there's a certain amount of apathy?
I think you can see extremes, everything from the apathetic people that don't believe it will happen or have no clue about what the hazards are locally, whether it be natural, technological, or a terrorism event, to the extreme of paranoia. And we're trying to prepare people on the side of preparedness so that they understand what our hazards are and what they can do themselves to help prepare for those hazards.
Robert Falsgraf, you teach this at Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. I'm wondering whether or not there is something of a disconnect here that Rita's describing where, you know, when there's a crisis in the country, everybody faces Washington and says, what are you going to do for us?
Well, yes, there is an expectation that we will have federal assistance. And in fact, we will need a great deal of federal assistance at the local level. The discrepancy, if there is one, is that the response is going to be local. We're talking to first responders if we're talking about how one meets a crisis, for example, in Boston or Kansas City or Seattle. But we will need, in order to meet that crisis, help from the federal government. Monetary help, certainly, in the way of new equipment, in the way of capabilities that we have not had, nor have we needed in the past, and also information. In advance so that we can prepare to minimize the effects if there is to be a strike against us. So we need to look at it at both ends, I think.
Nick, what's your perspective on this in terms of who's supposed to be taking responsibility for it?
Well, there's several levels of looking at the threat to our security. There are all kinds of course, natural disasters. We have earthquakes up here, things of that sort. So measurements like having additional water, flashlights, things of that sort are important to have, and we do have a system to set up communication between our citizens. Then you've got the larger sort of threat by terrorism, as one of your earlier spokespeople mentioned. Mm-hmm. There are so many targets out there. Where do you even begin? And I think that plays into the general populace's sense of sort of exhaustion. I mean, I'm not sure it's apathy, but so much as if there's these constant alerts out there, you know, whether it's yellow or orange, whatever, after a while it's sort of like, well, what do you do? If we go from a yellow to orange, there's no physical difference in pattern most people can take to something like that. As far as the responsibility is concerned, we recently, we being some council members, have sent letters to Congress asking that the most recent request by Senate Democrats for an additional $9 billion for Homeland Security be passed to the budget. The past budget had $3.5 billion request, and by the time that money came down to the municipal level, it was a small, much smaller amount. Often some of it gets siphoned off by the state for other reasons. So the municipalities in particular are hurting.
You know that the suggestions made, Nick, that doubling of money for Homeland Security in the fight over the budget in Washington is, you know, partly political as well as partly functional. You head up the Central Cities Council. I understand that's a forum of the 100 largest cities in the United States, exchanging information and ideas on this. Can that council, can the mayors make the case that more money is required, specifically that a lot more money is required?
Oh, we could easily make that case. The Central Cities Council, as you say, is a forum for the 100 largest cities under the National League of Cities. And our concern overall is that municipalities right now are undergoing a financial crisis, and that by shifting very needed funds to Homeland Security, which is basically a federal issue, we're hurting things like transit. And meanwhile, the budget is being cut back in transit by about $10 billion from 2 years ago. Meanwhile, the federal government's done a study that showed that we have $535 billion worth of needed infrastructure improvements in mostly in our urban areas over the next 20 years, mm-hmm. and that budget has been cut back so that it's only about less than $1 billion. So there's these tremendous infrastructure improvements or just funds needed to maintain the structures throughout the cities. And we've met with senators, we've been out there lobbying with the National League of Cities, and unfortunately the focus on the war has shifted from domestic needs to and supporting the military invasion of Iraq.
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, join our conversation about Homeland Security, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go first to Boston. And Nick's joining us. Hi, Nick.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I just want to say that I think the US government here has discovered the secret of the eternal perpetual motion machine. One part of the US government is going to spend limitless sums of money and effort on homeland security, while the real problem is that they're tackling the symptoms and not the cause. Other parts of the US government, and now, of course, the UK government, are actually creating the need for homeland security through its conduct of affairs around the world. Whatever you think of terrorists or these countries around the world that hate the US and now the UK, you have to recognize that there's, in their eyes, a cause for this. And it's to do, of course, with the conduct of foreign affairs, the use of the world's resources.
Well, Nick, so whether the threat is increased by the war in Iraq or by the foreign policy of the United States and the United Kingdom, as you're suggesting, isn't it important for the governments of both countries to say, all right, there's the threat, we're going to have to spend some money to address it, and then perhaps look at...
They're creating the threats. They're creating the very threats that are in one part of the government that the other part of the government is now having to spend large sums of money to address. So, of course, in the abstract way, of course you need to defend against external threats to the security of your country. But when you're creating those threats through your conduct, then it's a completely, well, it's not pointless. There's a cause behind all of this, and a point to this, of course.
All right, Nick, let me turn to Robert Falskap on this. I mean, it's certainly something that we've heard a lot about, particularly in the run-up to the war, that the threat simply being made worse by the policy of the government.
Well, I don't know. I disagree fundamentally with the premises of the questioner. First of all, over the last decade, the United States and the United Kingdom have given a great deal of help to Muslims. I'm thinking here of the Bosnian Muslims, for example, who were protected by us in the 1990s as they faced the possibility of ethnic cleansing, indeed the reality of ethnic cleansing. I also point out that the United States was attacked on 9/11, not in response to something that we had done specifically, but because of who we are, the fact that we are not the followers of Osama bin Laden, and that we stand for things that are diametrically opposed to what he stands for. So I doubt that short of our removing ourselves from this planet, we would eliminate ourselves as a target for the likes of Osama bin Laden, and therefore we have to fight back, and we have to do so on all fronts, both overseas and at home. And there is a connection between what we do overseas and what we do here in the United States, in my view. In other words, it is a broad front in which we operate, because we need to think of the threat as being from overseas, which has to be opposed as far from our shores as possible. That's how I look at it.
Rita Hoffman, let me hear from you, because I'm curious to know when people talk about homeland security in Olathe. Do they also broaden the conversation out to, you know, the justification for it and whether or not the government's responsible for making the mess that the country's in and all those sorts of points that we've heard before and we'll hear more of?
We haven't really gotten into that sort of a contention. People are basically wanting to know what to do. What is the reason for plastic and duct tape? We've done a lot of educational outreach to people in the last few weeks to educate them on how they can address the hazards, whether it be something extreme like a terrorist event or the natural and technological hazards we face every day in our communities. So a lot of people just don't know what to do or feel overwhelmed about the prospects of preparing for that type of an unthinkable event.
And Nick, what about you? You're one of those city councillors who's been outspoken in his opposition to the war. Do you make the sort of inexorable link that Nick in Boston does between government policy and homeland security in terms of trying to push back?
Well, yeah, yes, I do. You know, in Seattle, and I'm not sure what's going on in other cities, but there are neighborhood after neighborhoods of neighborhood organizations, usually around churches, who are very concerned about the war and about the invasion of another country without an immediate threat. So there's a very heightened sense here of the connection between the foreign policy and the possible threat to additional terrorist activities in Seattle and in the United States. And so there is a sense that if we hadn't been out there invading another country without immediate threat to us, that we wouldn't be facing a situation here where we see more of a potential terrorist threat.
Strip that away? Can you just say, you know, we can argue about the motivation, but the reality is this is a port. It's not that well protected. More money needs to be spent. More work needs to be done on homeland security. So as a city councilman in Seattle, I also need to focus specifically just on that practical bit of business.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, no matter what the cause is, it's still the threat. And we still need to get the funds to obviously protect the port. The port here is actually run separately from the city. So
right.
The $7 million I mentioned doesn't even cover the port costs, which probably half again as much. And we, you know, the combination, because of who we are and what we do, we will be face greater threats in the future. We're a very open, democratic, permeable society, and we've been very fortunate in the past because most of the terrorist activities have actually been homegrown as opposed to from the foreign sources. But nevertheless, the world's changing, and we will have to, unfortunately, put much more money into protecting our physical structures as well as our way of life. The other problem, of course, is as we take these measures, falling into the formula, of course, is more restrictions on our citizens and our exercise of civil rights. And that discussion hasn't even begun taking place this morning, but it is impacting us.
Okay, well, perhaps we'll get back to that. We're going to go for a break just shortly. So, Robert Falscraft, maybe just a word from you on the way the money's being directed, because there's certainly been lots of criticism, principally from the Hart-Rudman Commission, but others as well, that ports like Seattle and some of the other holes in the borders that need to be plugged just aren't getting the money that they need to do that kind of enhancing the security. Do you agree with that?
Well, I agree that what we need to do is provide more effective border security, and of course ports are a very important part of our borders. But again, we're doing a great deal since 9/11. The United States Coast Guard has a major role here, and the private sector as well as the governmental sector. We're beginning to inspect, for example, containers that go aboard ships at the ports of origin, not when they arrive in the United States. We need to push the borders out as far as we can in that regard, and we're doing that. But obviously much more needs to be done and more funds are needed for that purpose.
All right, and Connection listeners, this is the week that the Senate and the Congress will argue amongst themselves over just exactly how much money is spent on homeland security as part of a much larger package that the president has put before the politicians in Washington. We'd like to know from your perspective whether or not the money is being adequately, properly spent. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about homeland security. Nick Licata is with us from Seattle. He's a councilman there. Rita Hoffman is emergency management coordinator in Olathe, Kansas. She's on the line. And here in the studio, Robert Falscraft, professor of international security studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston. Pacey's on the line. Hi, Pacey.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Great. This whole discussion brought up a question that I've had for a while, which is, it seems that this new era that we're in raises questions about sort of systemic preparedness and the interrelationship of systems. So, for example, I was thinking about the healthcare crisis that we're in this country right now and how a lot of hospitals are currently turning away patients on regular days. And if we have another catastrophic event in this country, I'm wondering if the hospitals are prepared, and just in general, what that says about the interrelationship of lots of systems now that are impacted by, you know, our current war. You know, I think
right.
An earlier caller brought up the point about us maybe, you know, creating increased terrorism by our actions in Iraq and so forth. So it seems like we're in a new era here where systems are now interrelated and they're very complex relationships between these things, and I'm not sure that we've kind of dealt with those sort of systemic relationships.
Well, it's one of the points that, Robert, you write about in the conclusions of looking at Massachusetts, and I'm sure those conclusions apply across the country, and that is principally that a new mindset is needed.
Absolutely, a new mindset is needed to look at these issues. But let's look in particular at the issues, for example, of hospitals. For example, the hospital itself could be the object of terrorist attack, and that would be a wholly different kind of problem that we would face, and yet one we can't discount. We need to protect hospitals in the event of a crisis of this kind that we're discussing. But we also need to make sure that the information that is available in one emergency room is available elsewhere. And much has been done to do that, to make that happen as well. We need also what is called a surge capability in hospitals. As we all know, as a result of the healthcare over the last 25 years, the stay of a person in a hospital has been reduced, and therefore some hospitals that existed 25 years ago are no longer here now. So we need to think about the type of surge capability we need. We also need to think about how we communicate among the emergency rooms and that we know all of these
things. Where are we with
that,
though, Robert? Are we thinking about knowing that we need to think about it, or are those changes actually being made?
Changes are actually being made, and we've done a great deal in Massachusetts since 9/11 to set up that kind of network, and not only in Massachusetts, but between the hospitals here and in other parts of New England. But this needs to be done on a national basis more effectively than it has before.
Let's hear what's happening in Kansas, because, Ruth, you've been a reservist, a police officer, Rita, and an emergency dispatcher. Have the old rule books been thrown out and new ones being rewritten for this type of communication that Robert's talking about?
No, the focus just is increasing on the necessity to coordinate between different levels, vertically and horizontally, as we prepare for this. It means developing partnerships and better communications between all agencies involved.
Give me an example of something that's changed, though, Rita, of something that you've looked at or that the people in Olathe have said, you know, this is something that under the new regime we ought to change.
Well, we're becoming more involved regionally, coordinating regionally. We participate in the Mid-America Regional Council's Regional Homeland Security Coordinating Committee, for instance, because if it happens because we are part of a metropolitan area, it's not just going to affect one city, it will affect many. So the coordination efforts between agencies between Kansas and Missouri across the state line have to be improved. Agency partners locally improved, and then improved communications and coordination between the cities, the counties, the state, and the federal government. And those initiatives are taking place at the local level to improve our communications and coordination so that we are getting the information. We have people involved in Homeland Security from our Fire Marshal's Office, for instance, that are part of the Federal Bureau of Investigation's Joint Terrorism Task Force. So there are just a lot of issues that have to be improved and worked upon to make sure that every effort is made to ensure the security of our community.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Back to the phones. Brent's joining us now from Gloucester. Hi, Brent.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Yeah, what's up?
Well, you know, I was just listening to some of your other callers here, and I have to say I agree wholeheartedly with Nick from Boston that a reversal in foreign policy for this country is vital to increasing our security. But more on the homeland front, I have to tell you, I'm looking out my back window here, and I can see the Seabrook nuclear power plant on a clear day from across the water. And yet since 9/11, I've received nothing, you know, not so much as a mailing or a phone call or anything telling me what's been done to, you know, increase security on that level. And I'm curious about that because it doesn't seem that there's a whole lot being done. And your last caller from Boston mentioned that there's a lot being done in Massachusetts. And I'm just curious, you know, I mean, it doesn't seem to me like anyone in my neighborhood's even been informed about what to do should something like that, you know, an attack occur over there.
What about that, Robert? I mean, it's one thing to gather together the people who would be involved in the response. It's another to provide that kind of assurance to people like Brent that they're part of the picture.
Well, that's exactly right. In the case of Massachusetts, with the nuclear power plant that we have in Plymouth area, there has been a good deal done since 9/11. I'm not sure what has happened with Seabrook up in New Hampshire, but there has been much done here. That includes extending the perimeter. It includes increased surveillance. But again, this is an infrastructure area that is vulnerable. For example, how about an airplane that would fly into a nuclear power plant, something like that? That could create a major disaster for us. And that requires extending the security perimeter far out into the Atlantic, in the case of Seabrook and Plymouth both.
But doesn't it also involve, shouldn't it also involve making sure that the citizens who would be living within that perimeter are getting the kind of information that they would need on what radio to listen to or what preparations they ought to be making other than, you know, plastic sheeting and duct tape?
Absolutely. You're entirely right, and much more needs to be done there. That is an area that needs additional attention.
Nick Licata, how about in Seattle? Does the city take responsibility for providing the sort of assurance or comfort that Brent's describing there?
Well, we do to a certain extent. We've deployed extra staff, for instance, with dealing with our health situations to manage anthrax scares and other bioterrorism preparedness and response, because those elements are always going off. And in the fire department, additional staff, emergency units, and reconnaissance teams. But you have to understand, in our metropolitan area, we have a population approaching 2 million. We probably have 30 different municipal entities. Just coordination, as someone had mentioned earlier, is probably one of the biggest tasks, just to know what each of us is doing. And, of course, there are so many targets, everything from real sort of hard targets to potentially symbolic targets. And so just beginning to catalog them and then beginning to figure out how to notify people that they may be living next to a target, then telling them what they could possibly do, it's going to change the whole nature of what we do as a municipal government or as a state government in the United States if we go down this path of a perpetual war on terrorism.
So, Rita, if I came into your office and said, what should I do? Should I be, you know, getting ready for some kind of catastrophic event, and what should I do? Or should I be turning my attention more to what I might do as a citizen to prevent that event? What would you say?
I would say that it's each citizen's responsibility to know the hazards, and we've prepared materials countywide that we use in an emergency prepared neighborhood workbook that identifies local hazards and gives people a starting point to prepare. Having either an evacuation or a plan to have a safety spot, whether it be for severe weather or for sheltering in place for a chemical emergency, teaching people how to do that, how to put together at least a 72-hour kit so that they can care for their families if mm-hmm. something happens in the community. That's a starting point. Having people at least be aware that they're responsible for those kinds of things, getting them involved in the community emergency response team program so that they can be a help to the community when a disaster occurs, because we don't have enough emergency responders when something overwhelming like that happens. So it's getting everybody involved and getting them started on a preparedness plan for individuals, families, businesses, the whole community.
All right, let's see if I can get to Greensboro, North Carolina. Carol's on the line. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
I want to talk about the practical, the very, very, very practical aspects. I've heard Attorney General Ashcroft say over and over and over again that the first responders are going to be the local sheriffs, the local police, the local firemen.
Right.
Who are underpaid and overworked as it is. My state is totally bankrupt. The state I live in, they're facing a deficit that's just humongous. I know many of the states. Just how do we pay for this? How do we pay other than the very, very wealthiest states having the best homeland defense and the rest of us just sort of fearing for ourselves if we don't have some sort of federal funds infused?
Carol, let me ask you something. Just when you go around town doing your business in Greenboro, do you see any evidence of more police on the street or any kind of evidence of a higher level of preparedness now?
Well, no. I mean, practically no, and theoretically, yes. I think the police are being trained. But as I said, we have a police force that's just, there's barely a budget to keep them at the level. Some police officers start as low as $18,000. Firemen, same thing. None of the states that I know of have enormous amount of monies to put in. And if I'm not mistaken, Washington cut a lot of the extra money for extra police before 9/11. So we're sort of in a quandary facing billions of dollars of budget deficit. Do we shut down the schools? Do we shut down the hospitals to get more police? I mean, where does this money come from?
Kara, let's hear from Nick Licata in Seattle. It's one of the things that he's been pushing pretty hard, Nick, and it sounds like Carol's got her finger on the real difficulties here.
Well, exactly. The message that Carol's giving is being repeated 100 times around the country, and that the federal government, and I hold quite honestly both the Bush administration and both parties within Congress, that they have to step up to the plate and recognize that they cannot just simply say local governments need to do more. They need to fund it. They have not to date provided additional funding. And not only are we not seeing additional police on the streets, but in fact many of those police officers as well as firefighters are in the reservists, and those reservists are being called up. So as a result, we actually have fewer police on the streets because they're now in Iraq or being called up for the Iraq war. We have been back in D.C. lobbying, but so far I would say that, again, the war has diverted so much attention from Homeland Security or the need to fund that as a result, we're sort of limited to looking at different sort of amber-colored alerts as opposed to actually getting money to the cities.
And, Robert, are the people in charge of the Department of Homeland Security setting themselves up for some serious criticism if they don't start putting real money behind the first responders? We always seem to come back to that when we talk about Homeland Security.
Obviously, they're going to have to put a lot more money behind the first responders than they have so far. But again, remember, the Department of Homeland Security just came into existence over a month ago, and it is now receiving applications for grants, for funding, and large amounts of money are now being appropriated. The question is whether they're large enough. This is going to be a long-term issue. It's not something that's going to go away quickly, and therefore we've got to prepare for the long term here, and that's going to mean putting additional resources financially and otherwise into Homeland Security.
Well, we'll talk more about this on future programs. Thanks for being here with us, Robert. Robert Falsgraf, Professor of International Security Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. And Rita Hoffman, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Rita's Emergency Management Coordinator in Olathe, Kansas. Nick Licata, thanks for your time.
It's been my pleasure.
Nick is a councilman in Seattle. And earlier in the program, when we were talking about the war in Iraq, we heard from Thanasi Kambanis with the Boston Globe. He's currently in Qasr, was reporting on Basra. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Gail Harris, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Box, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugars. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
To purchase CDs or cassettes of The Connection, please visit us online at theconnection.org or call 1-800-909-9287.